Welcome to All Things Cardio-Oncology. My name is Steve Caselli. I'm the Executive Director of ICOS. And in this podcast, you'll hear from a diverse representation from our community. We want you to be both informed and inspired by their stories and experiences, and we're so glad that you've joined us today. Well, it's a pleasure to have with me today my co-host, as usual, Dr. Daniel Lenihan. Dan is the founding director and a vital team member here at ICOS and in everything we do. So welcome, Dan.
Thank you so much, Steve. And I know you're about to introduce our good friend, Richard Chang. So we look forward to hearing what's going on with him.
Yes, for sure. And Dan is here today as in a dual role. He's both host and guest because we're going to be talking today about a project in which he was also intimately involved. As he mentioned, our special guest today is Dr. Richard Chang. Richard wears many hats at the University of Washington in Seattle and beyond. He serves there as Associate Professor of Medicine in Cardiology and Radiology. He's the Program Director for Advanced Heart Failure Fellowship. He's the director of their cardio-oncology program and co-director of the amyloidosis program. And Richard, I don't know if I missed anything, but welcome. It's great to have you.
No, thank you, Steve and Dan. I'm very excited for this discussion today.
Well, yeah, today we want to discuss a paper that was recently published in the journal Heart, which the two of you were obviously intimately involved. Richard was the first author. Dan is the last author. The title of the paper is Moving Toward Establishing Centers of Excellence in Cardiac Amyloidosis. And it's an International Cardio-Oncology Society statement paper. Now, I've heard both of you in different contexts say that amyloidosis has historically been thought to be a rare disease. And the general perception was that the options for treatment were limited. But I've also heard you say that that landscape has really changed significantly in the last few years. So I wonder if you could just kind of frame this paper and our discussion by explaining what has led to an increase in diagnosis of this condition and how would you understand and explain that?
Yeah, I think there's several reasons why there's an increase in diagnosis. There's three major reasons from my perspective. I think the first thing is that there's increasing awareness and education. For example, some of the work that ICOS is doing in terms of educating the community, in terms of the key red flags to look for amyloidosis. So because of this, we are seeing more of these cases, both at major academic centers, but also in the community centers. The second thing is there's been a lot of advances in diagnostic modalities. So I think historically, it was a little bit unclear how to diagnose amyloid from the standpoint that we would often have tissue in order to make an accurate diagnosis. But nowadays, we know that even though you need tissue for light chain amyloid, for transthyretin amyloid, the majority of cases are diagnosed non-invasively with imaging. Thirdly, there's been the advent of very effective treatments over the last decade for both transthyretin as well as light chain amyloidosis. For this reason, there is a higher necessity for accurate diagnosis because now we can effectively treat the disease states. At least from my perspective, I think that's why we're starting to see more cases. Dan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the high points for sure. But you know, you could summarize a lot of what Richard just said in the basic story. I can remember talking to my cardiology colleagues just a couple of years ago, even where, you know, they were looking at some image and they were a bit suspicious about amyloidosis. And, you know, we started talking about what to do and how to get a move them down the road properly. And my colleague, this is literally just two or three years ago, said, well, what difference does it make if I make a diagnosis of amyloidosis? We don't really have anything to treat them with. And, you know, once I had to kind of get up from off the floor and realize that I just passed out, that, you know, I think that now the drug development in the space is so astonishing that and some of these treatments are really effective. So it definitely gives you a lot of motivation to find the condition as soon as you can and get the patient to a proper treatment. So that's really, to me, that's a summary of the biggest development in the field, is because now we have really effective treatments, especially if you get the right patient to the right treatment as soon as possible. So I don't know how you see all that landscape too, Richard.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. I think a lot of what, you know, you're talking about is definitely true. Because of these treatments, there's a much higher urgency to make the diagnosis as fast as possible and as accurately as possible.
So one of the really, one of the really big questions out there is, you know, it's all fine and dandy if you have somebody has the established diagnosis and you can then identify what's the right treatment. But the real quandary is how do patients find out about their diagnosis, or if they go to some primary doctor or some local physician and they report a bunch of nonspecific symptoms, you know, how do they get to the right diagnosis as soon as possible? That's really a big issue.
Yeah. And I assume that's part of the rationale for the paper that you all have drafted here, regarding, you know, the establishment of criteria for centers of excellence. As the diagnoses increases, the treatment option increases, obviously we want to see more centers develop where they're treating this effectively. So what was sort of the motivation for the drafting of this paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think the motivation behind this is that, as we already stated, there's a significantly increasing diagnosis of this condition. The challenge is there's a considerable variability right now in terms of how different centers practice. For example, you know, things may be done differently even down the street from University of Washington, you know, neighboring centers. And it's always hard to know in terms of what the best practice is. So I think one of the perspectives that we're trying to really drive home with this paper was really to understand what constitutes a Centers for Excellence. And this would sort of encompass the diagnosis and management of patients, as well as who may be involved in the care of patients with cardiac amyloid. One of the motivations was really to improve the overall care for this cohort by trying to figure out what, you know, what all of our centers should really be doing and offering in a coherent fashion. In order to do this, we created a survey in collaboration with a panel of amyloidosis experts to really understand what components should be included. For this, we received over 50 responses with international representation, including from the United States, as well as Brazil, Canada, Italy, and other countries. The majority of the respondents were cardiologists or hematologists oncologists, mostly because I think right now these are the practitioners that are mostly involved with these patients. From this survey, we tried to pull key elements with regards to the different domains for a center of excellence, including which team members are necessary, the various diagnostic modalities, the therapeutic options, as well as research programs. But I think ultimately, the point of this paper was really to try to highlight what the key aspects are to try to standardize care for these patients.
Yeah, and I think, you know, probably the biggest piece is, you know, when you talk about major centers, say for example the UK Amyloidosis Center, that's world renowned and has a huge system, and you know, there's all kinds of treatment options available there, or the Mayo Clinic in the US, or in your situation in Seattle, you're a known entity, and if someone comes up with the diagnosis of amyloidosis, then they can reach out to a major center and, you know, consider referring the patient there. That's going to be dramatically influenced by what the resources the patient may have, number one, and number two, how quickly or accurately would you make the diagnosis wherever the patient is? So the whole concept of centers of excellence was to have different levels of places. So a place like you know, where you work, obviously have a ton of resources, and they would be a major referral center. But there could be places that don't have those types of resources, but they could still make an expedited diagnosis. So how do you see that playing out in terms of a manuscript?
Yes. So, I mean, I think some of this is really looking at the patient journey. And as we already highlighted, there's a lot of variability in terms of what the individuals see, depending on what center they're at. Dan and Steve, as you know, it's not infrequent, particularly with light chain amyloidosis, that there's often a huge delay to diagnosis. The reason for this is a lot of the symptoms with amyloid are very nonspecific, such as fatigue, easy bruising, GI symptoms or shortness of breath. Historically, because of this, there's a lot of delays to diagnosis, and you often hear patients will tell you they've, you know, gone around to many different centers, have seen several doctors before an accurate diagnosis is made. I think the idea behind having these centers for excellence, as well as having tiers of centers for excellence, is really to help sort of navigate this complex process to make sure that the diagnosis is accurate. I think with transthyretin amyloid in general, it's not as difficult. And even though historically there were delays to diagnosis, in the contemporary era, because of the education awareness, this is no longer as much of an issue. But I think the same thing applies, that you want these centers for excellence, as well as a clear referral pattern, where when there's any question, let's say a center in a community, you know, the provider, they recognize a case, they're pretty sure a patient has it, but there's residual questions. Or, for example, if they need something like an endomyocardial biopsy, but it's not offered, the question is, where do you send the patients? I mean, I think having dedicated centers that you know can offer these various modalities is very valuable from that perspective, because you send it to these special centers and are able to rapidly do what's necessary to confirm the diagnosis. But not only that, they can also quickly initiate treatments. I think that's the other aspect to this. With all these newer treatments, even though they're all great, they're very expensive. And I think this applies to both light chain amyloidosis, for example, with daratumumab, as well as with transthyretin amyloid, with all the various therapies, with the stabilizers, as well as silencers, they're exceedingly expensive. And what will often happen in smaller centers who don't deal with this often, there's going to be a lot of roadblocks in terms of getting patients onto treatment in a quick fashion. I think the expertise at some of these larger centers isn't only in the diagnosis, but it's really navigating these roadblocks that may exist in terms of getting patients onto the appropriate treatment.
If you or your institution would like to have credentials that confirm your qualifications as a cardio-oncologist or a cardio-oncology center of excellence, we encourage you to consider applying for our certification exam in cardio-oncology or our certification for centers of excellence. These are the only certifications currently available in this field, and it's a special opportunity for you or your institution to distinguish yourself, recognizing your expertise in the field. More information about both these opportunities can be found at ic-os.org, or you can email directoricos@gmail.com for more information.
Yeah, that's a super important point. And I think one thing you kind of mentioned in the middle there is, you know, the connections between centers, for example. So if you had a gold center, which clearly they have the resources to diagnose and treat, but if they have a connection with a silver or a bronze center, that connection is solid, then someone in a bronze center knows exactly who to contact if they ultimately come up with a diagnosis, or even if they have suspicious tests. So establishing those connections, I think, is a really important key to actually make this work. What are your thoughts there, Richard?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think it's having these relationships, as well as knowing where to send the patient whenever there are questions. As part of the manuscript, we did look to see what sort of defines the essential components for center of excellence. In this, I think what underlies a lot of these programs is also having a multidisciplinary team that works together, at least in kind of what we consider gold centers. This would include cardiologists, hematologists, oncologists, but also nephrologists, neurologists, pathologists, genetic counseling, GI doctors, and others. And I think this is what kind of might separate some centers from others, in a sense that, you know, these centers that you termed as bronze centers, for example, in the community that don't see many of these patients, might not have the full spectrum of expertise. By sending them to a larger center, the hope is that they'll get comprehensive evaluation by all the experts, and they're able to do this in a consolidated fashion to make a clear treatment plan for the patients. Some of the other aspects to this is that the major centers will have advanced multimodality imaging, including advanced parameters for cardiac MRI, for example, which can facilitate not only the accurate diagnosis, but also aid in prognosticating the long-term outcomes for these patients. And we already touched on this, but again, the access to therapies is very important, because in some of these community centers, if, for example, they try getting a patient onto treatment and they're unable to, what can sometimes happen is once they're referred to a larger center, just purely because of going through the process repetitively, I think a lot of the larger centers will be able to get the patients onto treatment quicker, but oftentimes they'll be able to have more success in terms of getting it through insurance.
Well, and I think the other concept would be, say you have a person that lives many hours away from a major center and they don't have the capacity to go there frequently. If you ultimately made the diagnosis and you were definitive in terms of the diagnosis and what the treatment was, the subsequent follow-ups could happen locally. And then only if the process wasn't going according to plan, or, you know, you thought that there needed to be a change in therapy, the patient would follow locally and not have to travel many hours away to a major center. And so having coordination between the centers and communicating about developments that may be occurring, having that whole process seamless, to me it seems like our frontier. What we can do to make that actually work is a key element to this whole process. And could you maybe explain some of the ways in which you are doing that? I'm aware of you know, what you've told me before about how you're reaching out to places that may be quite a distance away from your main center.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I 100% agree with your comments, in a sense that having a shared care model with the non-academic centers is really critical. We do this very frequently at our center, not only for amyloid patients, but we do this for all of heart failure, as well as, for example, you know, we do this with our LVAD patients and our other patient cohorts. But I think specific to amyloid, you're correct. I mean, a lot of these patients, sometimes they tend to be very elderly. It's, you know, not only do they live far away, it may be very difficult for them to travel. So oftentimes what we'll do is we see these patients, we define a clear treatment plan. I think open communication with the local providers is also very important. And we do this both via electronic communication, but also phone calls. I think one of the other responsibilities for these centers for excellence is really to provide education to community, including to these shared care model centers, in terms of both, you know, when to suspect amyloid, how to manage it, but also when they should be concerned and when to send the patient back. I think one of the things, one of the other advantages that you have with this pairing is oftentimes the major academic centers will have a lot of clinical trials, which may not necessarily be available in the community. And I think having a shared care model would also create a clear pathway for access to these clinical trials.
Yes, that's a super important point. I think some of the trials may be, you know, strictly oral medications or whatever, and those could be done at a more rural or community-based program. That could be easily done. But if you have, you know, intensive IV or sub-Q or frequent monitoring type protocols, then obviously those would have to be at a major center. And I think making sure that, you know, I know a couple of the new therapies that are being developed for AL, for example, the monoclonal antibodies to light chains, these are potentially going to be very important treatments ultimately. But I know at least in two of the trials, the phase three trials for those drugs, the requirement was that the patient would be seen prior to initiating any therapy. So that's a very short window. If you are in a relatively rural or community-based program and you come up with a diagnosis of AL amyloidosis, really you have 1 or 2 weeks to get a patient to a major center. You need to have those communication pathways already well established so that that could actually happen. So have you had any experience in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're fortunate, at least in our program, that for light chain amyloid specifically, we work very closely with the Fred Hutch Cancer Center here. And they do have a hub and spoke model where they have affiliations with many of the other centers in the region. And because of that, there's rapid communication as well as referring from the community centers to the main Fred Hutch campus whenever these cases do arise, only because, again, a lot of it is really seeing these diseases a lot and knowing what to do because they do see it a lot. I would say in the case of transthyretin amyloid, it's very similar. Where we have very close relationships with the community. We'll often do webinars, for example, I think you were alluding to this earlier, but we do this once every several months where we have providers from the community present difficult or challenging cases of amyloid. And then, you know, we review the cases together to try to come up with an idea of what's going on as well as how best to manage the patients. How about yourself, Dan? What's been your experience with these types of models?
Yeah, I think for some of these clinical trials, you know, where time is really of the essence, then, you know, you have to have established connections already. It's not like there can't be an administrative delay of an excessive period of time. There has to be, you know, significant facilitation there. And then in terms of, you know, you might have a little more leeway in ATTR, but still just being aware of what's being developed is really key. So those major centers need to communicate that information to the community or rural centers, you know, that we have this trial and it's looking for these kind of patients. And if you have anybody that you're interested in, you know, give us a call, send us a text, email, whatever. I mean, you know, however that communication can be facilitated, that's what we need to do. I would like to, you know, sort of wrap up by, you know, since this is an International Cardio-Oncology Society podcast, I think we are always trying to think of how can we actually, you know, impact care. Obviously, most of the time it's in the cardio-oncology space, but because amyloidosis really travels in the same field as cardio-oncology, and you're not going to get to a diagnosis of ATTR until you exclude AL. So we feel like this is a particular area that cardio-oncology needs to be involved in. How do you think ICOS can help improve the care of patients with amyloidosis? How do we move forward on this?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, but I can tell you what I think. I think ICOS has already done a lot. ICOS is a leader in the incorporation of both cardiologists as well as hematologists, oncologists in their work groups and communities. And I think this is really critical when you're looking at a disease state such as amyloid, where you do want both involved. Obviously, for light chain amyloid, you need the collaboration for the optimal management of these patients. But I think even for TTR, for example, oftentimes there is overlap for patients with TTR with MGUS purely because of an aging population. So we do need our hematology colleagues to help us manage our patients from that standpoint. I think the other key aspect to this is the international parts. There's a lot of variability in terms of the resources that different regions have available, as was what treatment options are available. And I think by creating this community of diverse individuals and expertise from around the world, it really helps underscore what the best practices may be. They may not always be available in every region, but I think understanding what may be available in some regions and what's not available from others really helps push the field forward, right? Because you might ask, for example, why is tafamidis available in the United States for TTR cardiomyopathy, but it's not necessarily approved for that indication, or it's not available for that indication, for example, in the UK. I think those types of questions certainly need to be explored. But because of that, it really helps, I think, push the field forward, but also educate the community as well as the patients. So I think from that regard, really the sharing of information, incorporation of expertise from cardiologists, hematologists, and oncologists, as well as sort of defining what the best treatment options are. In addition to that, collaborating with other professional groups and societies is really important in establishing and disseminating the standards for best practices.
Well, Richard, this has been fantastic. And as always, you're on top of the game there. So I think that, you know, we look forward to maybe we'll have an update on this topic in 6 or 7 or 8 months, something like that, and see what's developed. Obviously, we feel very strongly that there are ways that we can facilitate patient care in this disease space. Steve, so how do you want to close us out today?
Yeah, it's incredibly encouraging to hear the two of you talk about this in terms of the amazing progress that's been taking place in this area. And we are thrilled to be a small part of facilitating that. We're working on new educational programs and projects where we hope to promote the kind of collaboration that you all are describing. We have a amyloidosis awareness fund that I will put a link in the show notes to, the Rachel Levine Amyloidosis Fund. I'll put a link there and then a link to the paper as well. So just thank you both for your time. We do look forward, as Dan said, to hearing an update before too long. So thank you both for being here. For more information about ICOS, you can go to ic-os.org, where you'll find more information about all of our programs, including our weekly webinars, our board certification exam, and other resources that we know you'll find helpful. Thanks for joining us today, and we hope to hear from you soon.